this is Steffi, and welcome to the Financial Fox, investing and innovation ideas with a twist. Today, we are putting Bitcoin under the microscope with Robert Breedlove, ex-fund manager, writer, and founder of Parallax Digital. Robert is known as a strong proponent of Bitcoin. He describes himself as a freedom maximalist and a philosopher in the Bitcoin space. Obviously, we are not going to discuss only Bitcoin, but also fiat, crypto, gold. What is money? We will look at inflation, monetary system, how the governments are dealing with the current economic crisis post-COVID, and finally, the evolution of the world into a video game, which is kind of exciting. So, if you're new to crypto and Bitcoin, don't worry, stay tuned, because you are going to love this interview. But before we kick off, make sure that you subscribe to our YouTube and podcast channels. Follow us on social media to stay up to date with news and engaging conversations. Every week, we will bring to you a new interview with a leading crypto or market expert to discuss innovation, the world of crypto, investment, and finance. It is also important to remember that I'm not a financial advisor and the content here is only for education and information purposes only. So let's get into. Hi, Robert. How are you?
I'm doing well. How are you?
I'm fine. It's awesome to have you back on the show. I mean, we have been talking, what was last year, just in the summer, and Bitcoin is kind of making its move, but you know, see where we are now. Unbelievable.
Yeah, it's come quite a ways in a year.
Yeah. Anyway, listen, for the viewers that don't know who you are, it might be helpful that, you know, you give us information about your background and, you know, all your experience in Bitcoin as well.
Sure. My name is Robert Breedlove. I'm the founder and CEO of Parallax Digital. For the past 4 years, we've been operating a number of hedge funds in the crypto asset space. My background before that is as a certified public accountant. I have a master's, undergraduate and master's degree in accounting and finance. I had been a career CFO before getting into crypto. So I've always been a numbers guy, I guess you could say. And then I've always had a fierce curiosity about history and technology. And I decided last year, I guess it was a wake-up call for a lot of people, but my wake-up call was it's really hard to outperform the best performing asset in human history. And I was spending all my time and energy trying to do that. So I decided, and I guess was part of my journey as well into Bitcoin. I mentioned that I'd been a lifelong curious person. I'd always been reading a lot, but I'd never been writing. I'd started writing the past few years as a result of getting into Bitcoin and trying to share the insights I had found about it. And that writing has started to become popular, and that writing transformed into media appearances, talking to people about Bitcoin. Those became popular as well. And so the decision or the realization that I had was I could really just get out of the hedge fund business and focus on this side of Bitcoin that I really enjoy, which is learning and educating. And that's exactly what I did. So I've been fortunate enough to sort of pivot out of hedge fund world and move into what I guess you could call as Bitcoin education. But as we've touched on before, Bitcoin touches everything in the world, right? So the name of the show, for instance, is the What is Money Show. So it's the fact that Bitcoin causes us to ask these fundamental questions that encourages us to revamp our worldview as we go down the proverbial Bitcoin rabbit hole. And that's where I'm at today. I'm just focused on learning and educating as much as I can. And I think the timing has been really fortuitous because the world... Again, thanks to Bitcoin's number go up technology, the world's really paying attention again. So a lot of these narratives we've been sharing for years, like we talked a little bit about Ray Dalio before the podcast, like I wrote a letter to him I guess 2 years ago now, talking about Bitcoin back when he was an ardent opponent of Bitcoin. And now, you know, today he's come out and said, hey, it's viable and it belongs in your portfolio. So that's the battle we're fighting, I think, is education. I actually heard this quote from H.G. Wells. He said, civilization is a race between education and catastrophe. And I think that's pretty fitting for where we are with Bitcoin today.
Yeah, exactly. Well, listen, you mentioned about Ray Dalio, who changed his mind. So I'm just going to mention some other people. They are not really supportive of Bitcoin, or they've got some concern, and you are going to defend your thesis. So Peter Schiff, right? So basically what he's saying, Bitcoin is a bubble, is not a real good, for instance, like gold, and basically doesn't have a measurable value, but, you know, the price is up because everybody believes the narrative that the price of Bitcoin is never going to come down, right? And obviously, it can be an alternative asset, an alternative investment to fight inflation, right? What would you say to Peter Schiff that believes that Bitcoin doesn't have a value?
What's funny, I guess, first of all, about gold bugs, Peter Schiff is a very notable gold proponent, or gold bug, as they referred to pejoratively sometimes. What's funny about gold bugs and Bitcoiners is that we actually agree on more than we disagree. So we agree that the money is broken in the world, that the fiat currency complex is corrupt. We agree to the solution, actually. We agree that the solution is sound money, money that exists outside of the purview of the state, but we disagree on what optimal sound money is. Gold bugs believe it is gold. Bitcoiners believe it is only Bitcoin, can only be Bitcoin. And there's some overlap in between, people that think maybe we need a little bit of both. But with Peter specifically, it's very easy, I think, to just write Bitcoin off as a bubble and not look deeply into it. And I think, I don't know, Peter seems to have built this kind of career niche out of just trolling Bitcoiners, because he's getting so much social media engagement, just repeating the same tropes over and over and over. So I don't even know if he believes them, frankly.
Is a big proponent, by the way.
His son, yeah. And now his son has come out recently and they're going back and forth where, you know, his dad's expressing his disappointment in his son's Bitcoin thesis and his son's firing back. So it could all be just a publicity stunt. I'm not sure. But the funny thing about even gold bugs that have this deep education on money is that when you ask them why, like, what are the properties of gold that made gold become money? This is very important, and it's very close to economic first principles, is that human beings attach value to the non-physical aspects of goods. So we attach value to the services a good can render us. It's not about the physical item at all. It's actually about whatever that thing, whether it's a good service, could be a reputation, whatever the thing can do for us. That's what we value. And in the sphere of money, you know, I've hammered this a lot in many of my media appearances. There are five services that money can render to us that humans attach value to. And those are the first principles of money, essentially. And they're divisibility, durability, recognizability, portability, scarcity. Bitcoin is objectively superior, you know, exponentially superior even to all monies, including gold, across all properties of money or all services that money renders to us. It's an objectively better technology. That's what's happening, is that gold is the best thing we ever had, the best tool we ever had to fulfill those services across history. It's been doing it for 5,000 years, so it has a very established head start. It's very deeply rooted in human psychology, even. You know, I often say that gold is a tool that everyone knows is valuable, but almost no one can tell you why, right? People just think there's just an intuition almost at this point that gold is, has this value beyond its utility use case, right? It is money. It's a form of money, but very few people could recite to you the properties that the free market selected for across time. But once you get there, like you're now to the first principles of money, and this is why it's hard to understand Bitcoin. And then you look at Bitcoin through that lens, you understand that that's what's happening. It's that these, this set of services that Bitcoin is rendering to market participants, it is doing it in a superior fashion than what gold could provide. And so therefore, and I've tweeted this at Mr. Schiff before, it is impossible, in my opinion, to be bullish gold and bearish Bitcoin. Because if you are bullish gold for the right reasons, you understand as the monetary properties, like what made gold gold, divisibility, durability, recognizability, portability, scarcity, and then you're evaluating Bitcoin through the same lens, you cannot be bearish a technology that is superior across all dimensions and maintain your mental coherence. So I guess the options are either Peter Schiff is doing it as a publicity stunt, which is maybe good for his business, lets him talk his book a lot, lets him get a lot of social media engagement. He doesn't understand money from first principles. He's just an entrenched gold guy, right? He grew up thinking gold was money and now this is what he believes. Or, you know, maybe he's, there's always the possibility of playing the 4D chess where he's, you know, secretly accumulating a lot of Bitcoin in the background while decrying it in public. So
I think it's kind of interesting. I mean, you mentioned before that even gold, the proponent of gold and the proponent of Bitcoin, they do believe the same fundamentals, so that the economy is broken, fiat is not going to go anywhere. And then when you see the government keeps printing money, there is no way that the economy is going to grow. So that is kind of an interesting point. Now, I want to bring up another gold proponent, but I think it kind of, at least he's listening at you, because he mentioned you a few times, and he's Robert Kiyosaki. He's the best-selling author of Rich Dad, Poor Dad. And I was listening to an interview that he did recently on Kitco, and he was saying Bitcoin is untested, right? But it is a store of value. And I've been talking to Robert Breedlove. So he shows some skepticism, but it's kind of open to listen. And also he was saying something interesting that I want to bring up here. He said Bitcoin will adapt. And I like that thing. So it didn't explain it a lot. And maybe I wanted to ask you. So you were talking to him. What do you think he meant when he said Bitcoin will adapt to the changes, you know, that are happening in the crypto spheres, you know, DeFi?
Yeah. Yeah. So I spoke to Robert again recently. I think we have an episode coming out again soon. And I'm walking through where I see money going over the next 10 to 15 years. I think we're, you know, Paul Tudor Jones calls this the great monetary inflation that we're going into. And this is another one of those terms that people don't understand. We think inflation, most people think it's like normal and healthy or whatever. It's awful. It tears society apart when it gets really bad, and inflation's about to get really bad. So, definitely check out that episode. It's, you know, important to prepare ourselves for what I think we're about to go into, with all of the fiat currency printing. But Robert is, yeah, again, as you said, a notable gold proponent. But he does, at least from my perspective, appear to be much more open-minded. He's been willing to engage intellectually and comparing gold and Bitcoin. And, you know, he's advocated for all of them in your portfolio. And he's also self-proclaimed old guy. He's like, this is just what I know. And, you know, you young guys have all this other stuff figured out. I would say that on adaptation, he's probably referring to Bitcoin, the fact that Bitcoin is open source technology that we can build different integrations into, and it does adapt, right? So Bitcoin, one thing that's very interesting about it is that it has this asymmetry of governance built into its network such that it resists any harmful changes. So any changes to its core consensus rules, which are, you know, pretty much 21 million Bitcoin, you can't confiscate it, you can't inflate it, you can't spend it without a valid signature. It resists changing any of that that could actually harm holders, but it is still flexible enough to accommodate beneficial changes. So one obvious one here is the divisibility of Bitcoin. Today, we can divide each Bitcoin into 100 million subunits called Satoshis. If for whatever reason, Bitcoin monetized to the extent that that divisibility was no longer accommodating of economic activity. So say one Satoshi was worth $10 or something like that. We needed more divisibility. You could very easily soft fork the protocol and increase that divisibility to a trillion or whatever it needed to be. So Bitcoin can adapt in that sense, that it has these hard rules that no one can change, which is really valuable, really important in an adversarial game like money. But it has this openness to beneficial rules. So it is adaptive. Whereas gold is just a shiny, dumb rock, right? Sitting in a vault. You can't do anything. You can't integrate digital technology to gold. And in fact, there's some projects out there where people are claiming to be a gold-backed crypto or this, that, and the other. But the problem that we've yet to figure out or overcome is the Oracle problem. So at the end of the day, you can have a gold-backed crypto, but you still have to trust some intermediary at some point. Someone's got the gold sitting in a vault and they're representing via an audit function or attestation function to that crypto asset that, you know, there's 100 tons worth of gold crypto for this 100 tons of gold I have in my vault. There's trust necessary in some intermediary at some step in the chain. And only with Bitcoin can we completely eliminate the need for trust in any counterparty, individual or institution. And that's the key property. Money is all about trust minimization. You want to be able to hold something that you know can hold its value across time and is insulated from any nefarious intent from others, whether it's inflationist, people trying to steal your money, stop your payments, etc.
Listen, on that point, I mean, we are talking about Bitcoin adaptation. We are talking also about how the crypto ecosystem is evolving. And obviously, we can mention DeFi. So do you think that Bitcoin is going to be also a key element of the DeFi ecosystem? I mean, we see there are projects out there actually building DeFi on Bitcoin, like Sovereign, which I wanted to mention. But how do you see DeFi and Bitcoin coming together or not?
Yeah, the experimentation that's occurring in DeFi today, I'm less immersed in it lately. There's a lot, like the whole crypto space. We have Bitcoin at the core, which is this world-shattering innovation. Like I mentioned, disrupting gold, which is something we can't even fathom, by the way. You know, gold's been money for 5,000 years. The fact that that's being disrupted, the consequences of that are nearly unimaginable. I'm trying to write about it in my piece called Sovereignism recently, but it's a big, 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 big deal, like way bigger than the internet. So there's that at the core of the crypto space. And then there's all this scammy garbage DeFi, you know, NFTs, celebrity tokens, blah, blah, blah. There's just a lot of scammy, misguided projects surrounding this world-shattering innovation. So not to discount everything completely. I mean, it is very akin to venture capital, you know, that's highly liquid. People can go and experiment with these projects. It's not exactly clear how a lot of these tokens capture value yet. They've been, you know, they go into these huge speculative fervors and then they crash, and they're really highly correlated to Bitcoin. So it's a really murky market to make sense of. But my general outlook on DeFi is that by dematerializing money, right? We've now digitized gold in a way. We've created a digital disruptor to gold in Bitcoin. That will so radically transform the finance landscape as we know it today, which is heavily based on trust and indebtedness and counterparty, like systemic counterparty networks. It's going to collapse the need to do a lot of that counterparty, take acceptance of counterparty risk. You don't need to trust these chains of IOUs as much when money can be settled instantly globally. So I see a lot of this DeFi activity trying to emulate the traditional financial system. You know, they're trying to create loan books that look like, you know, can be something better than what Wall Street's currently doing. But I think what Wall Street's currently doing is not a viable function in the world we're moving into. So
that's interesting, because you are basically saying they are emulating what is out there, but the real disruption hasn't really come and will come naturally when Bitcoin is going to be more adopted and it will become more established.
Yes. Yeah. So another way to think about this is that the shape and character and types of socioeconomic structures we have built on top of gold, they're built due to the central bank, for instance. It emerges as a centralized custodian for gold because gold cannot be moved across space very easily. So there were economies of scale to centralize the custody of gold and issue paper backed by gold. Now, this gave that centralized issuer the power to abuse that power, the power to abuse its customers by printing more money than they have gold reserves. So that the shape of the central bank as an institution is rooted in the technological shortcomings of gold. Bitcoin does not suffer that technological shortcoming of portability. So we don't need a central bank. We don't need a centralized custodian. So when you this is what I'm trying to articulate. It's kind of tricky. It's like we have this technology stack of civilization. Gold is the base layer. And then we built up these socioeconomic systems around it to mitigate the technological shortcomings of gold itself. But when we remove the technological shortcomings of gold, all of a sudden, a lot of these institutions are irrelevant. So I think the future, like going into a Bitcoin standard, all our institutional forms look radically different. But DeFi is trying to mirror 20th century finance in digital space. And I don't think a lot of that ports over nicely. And in addition, it's debt-based. It's debt-based. I think debt as a component of global GDP collapses on a Bitcoin standard. Everyone will prefer equity-based money.
Okay, interesting. So if we are mentioning here Jerome Powell, that is basically saying Bitcoin is a vehicle of speculation, it doesn't have any value as a payment, and I will compare it like to gold. So he's actually making a comparison to gold, but he's basically saying that it's a vehicle of speculation, which then it brings back everything that kind of the governments are doing, printing money, and perhaps how they are going to try to regulate and limit the the expansion of Bitcoin. For example, they could put a limit on how much many the institution can get, or we can see some countries such as Turkey recently, or that ban crypto payment, or for instance, or even India, which could be probably the next one. So, what would you say to that?
I guess in general, the regulations are just not going to affect the Bitcoin network, the core operations of the Bitcoin network. In terms of what Jerome Powell is saying, it's a testament to how deceptive central banks can be. So now he's trying to say, oh, gold's been used as an instrument for speculation for centuries. So he's trying to discount gold's role in the socioeconomic hierarchy, when in fact, so he's talking out of one side of his mouth, but the other side of his mouth is central banks are accumulating gold as they print more money. They're trying to hedge against one another's counterparty risk. And if one country invades another, they will only accept tribute payment in gold. So gold still, it remains the only relevant geopolitical money in the world today. But a central bank will never tell people that. They've waged this. The right way to think about this is governments have waged a cold war on gold. They've tried to discredit it. They've had, you know, decades of anti-gold propaganda. There's a great book on this called Gold Wars by Ferdinand Lips. And he walks through just the history of governments trying to suppress this narrative of gold as money, but gold as free market money always appreciating, like no matter how much money they printed, it always acted as an insurance policy on central banks. And the reason is gold historically has been the governor of governments, meaning that if you abused your monetary policy, and this is at even a national level or even a bank level, if they printed too much money, like they expanded the money supply way in excess of their gold reserves, then gold would begin, people would start to take them up on those claims and gold would flow out of their country or their bank. So gold created this natural regulatory, you know, natural check on abusive monetary policy across history. So what we have today is that governments have effectively colluded or acted in concert to try and move onto this fiat currency standard and move away from the governance mechanism that gold imposed upon them. But that doesn't work either because governments are also antagonistic to one another. So as money supplies have been expanding, they've been buying gold in tandem. So my general advice is to just never listen to what they say, watch what they do. Yeah. Actions speak louder than words. They're buying gold hand over fist. And I think all these attempts at stifling Bitcoin transactions from a regulatory standpoint are just intended to give, people operating behind the political veil more of an opportunity to acquire Bitcoin.
Okay, interesting. So how do you think they are actually going to bring the economy back up to some kind of sensible level or beginning of growth? Because now the prices are going up, production is going down, importing is going up. They are basically they are making the illusion the economy is growing, but they buy printing money, which is impossible because economy grow if you produce goods and services, right, which is not happening. Yeah. So how do you think they're going to break that cycle?
They're going to fail, frankly. Bitcoin bankrupts nation states. So this illusion that they've been upholding for many decades is that we can just keep printing. Every time something goes wrong in the economy, every time we have the structure of production no longer matches, the structure of consumption in the market, they can just print money and induce demand. Basically, they're trying to Pavlov's dog. When you hit the button and, you know, the dog thinks the food's coming out, it starts to drool and he gets hungry and he goes out. They think they can just control populations like this by pressing this button on printing money, but that's not how an economy works. And if you read Mises, he'll tell you that monopolizing a money supply and entering into a monetary and credit expansion can only end in one of two ways. And it's either they stop expanding the money supply and there's a massive deflationary shock and all pricing across the entire market returns to supply and demand equilibrium, or they keep printing and you ultimately destroy the currency system and what he calls the crack up boom, or we would call hyperinflation. And central banks and nation states nation states are the biggest debtor in the room. Central bank is serving the interest. Nation state politicians are serving the interests of central bankers, but central bankers are there also to serve the interest of the biggest debtors, which are nation states. They'll continue to print money. The incentives would indicate that they'll continue to print money until the currency fails. And that's what we've seen time and time again throughout history. That's why there have been hyperinflations, is that we put one group in a position that they can confiscate wealth via inflation from the entirety of society or their underlying civilization. They can steal, they can rob the whole population. Instead of being constrained to their own balance sheet to wage war or enact policy or do whatever government action they've determined suitable, they now have access and recourse to the savings of the entire society operating on the currency. So that's what's going to happen. There is no there is no such thing as how we're going to bring growth back. How, like, this is a key point. A legislator cannot create economic wealth. The legislator's pen absolutely cannot create economic wealth in the world. It simply cannot. It can only redistribute it. So what we are going to see, and this is, I know it's a lot to chew on, but when you read, again, Mises, he'll make the point that there's no such thing as a government action that's not tyrannical, basically, because there's the market is how we express our wishes and values and wants, right? It's people buying and selling. Any government action that's antithetical to the market, so any regulation or monopolization, is contradictory to that, to the aggregate wishes of market participants. So it destroys itself over time through they're basically defaulting on their debts through currency inflation. But now, again, gold had historically kind of been the check on that, but they had cornered the market on gold and whatnot. Now we have this true irrepressible barometer in Bitcoin that I think is just going to eat all the money for this very reason.
You're basically saying that it will be actually the revolution will come from the people, that as Bitcoin become mass adoptive, that is going to disrupt the current system, the current
economy. You can think about, the name I've used in my recent writing is that Bitcoin is the ultimate offshore bank.
Yes.
So the more we print money, no one can hide the price of Bitcoin. They can hide and manipulate the price of gold across history to protect people from flooding out of currencies into gold. You can't do that with Bitcoin. They don't have the market cornered. So they're going to keep printing money. The price of Bitcoin is going to continue to boom. People are going to start suffering under inflation, trying to do anything they can to protect themselves. Bitcoin is going to continue to be the best performing asset in human history. And then it will dawn on people out of necessity, frankly, that, hey, here's a vehicle that I can shelter my wealth in that no one can touch, that keeps appreciating the more money they print. And as people exit fiat and go into Bitcoin, you've now collapsed 50% of the nation state revenues. 50% of US revenues in 2020 were inflation. They printed about $4 trillion. We had about $4 trillion in direct tax receipts. So you've gutted 50% of a nation state's revenue model. And people are now holding their savings in the hardest to tax asset in human history. It's just information. It can be moved anywhere. So that's also going to put downward pressure on the other half of the revenue model, which is non-consensual taxation. And through this mechanism, you know, my thesis is at least that Bitcoin bankrupts the nation state in this century.
Okay. Wow. This will lead a complete redistribution of wealth as well. So just to close up, I kind of want you to go through the work that you have been doing, because you have interviewed some leading figures in the Bitcoin space, but also they are part of the current institution. For example, Michael Saylor and his move into Bitcoin, which is kind of pioneering, let's say. How do you see, first of all, can you share, you know, your experience and, you know, what you have learned as well from this experience and what you are doing? And also, how do you see financial institution changing that behavior towards this new asset class?
Yeah, so I started the What is Money show with the Saylor series. Michael and I spoke for about almost 12 hours, and we have 9 episodes released so far. We're scheduled to do one more. You know, a lot of these things we talked about, where gold is a dumb rock, basically, and Bitcoin is adaptive. Michael and I went deep into that. He's a brilliant guy. Frankly, I learned a lot from our conversation. I think if you're interested in learning more about the overall socioeconomic significance of Bitcoin in a broader scope of history, that the series we did together is the best thing you can watch. We actually start in the Stone Age. You know, we build his worldview from first principles. We spend the first 4 hours without even talking about Bitcoin. We're just talking about Stone Age technology, history, how we got to where we are. Then we start to explain the digital age and how Bitcoin fits in. So it was a heck of a journey for me. I really enjoyed it. I learned a lot. The feedback has been tremendous. People are saying it's the best thing they've ever seen on Bitcoin. They've watched it 5 times. They can't get enough. You know, it's like a Harvard master's degree in 15 hours, you know, on monetary history, something like that. I'm doing more of these series. So I recorded with Jeff Booth last month. We're about to start releasing the Booth series. My intention is to sit down with the most prolific thinkers in the world and have these long form conversations to externalize their mind and really get to the first principles of their worldview. In terms of, I guess, how this is impacting institutions, I mean, certainly seems like everyone's waking up. You know, Elon came out a few months later and announced they would put $1.5 billion into Bitcoin. I don't know for certain that him and Michael were talking, but I think they were. I know it's not good decorum to talk about any private conversations they had, but, you know, they had some Twitter exchange together. And I think it's just a testament to the intellectual gravity of Bitcoin. So, like, once you start looking at it and you get to the bottom of it, the correct response is like, okay, this thing is the most, the market has always selected for these properties of money. This thing has perfected the properties of money. That's what's happening. That's why it's the best performing asset in human history. You know, even if you don't believe anything that I have to say or anything that Michael has to say, but you determine with even a 0.1% chance that it's true, right? We have to evaluate all situations probabilistically. You have to assign some probability to it. Whatever that probability is, should be your position size. And that's what you're seeing happen, right? So Dalio is like 0% for a long time, but he studies it for 2 years and he's like, all right, maybe it's 3 to 5%. So now he's going to have a 3 to 5% allocation in his funds. Well, that 3 to 5% allocation is not going to pull more value out of the fiat currency complex, increase Bitcoin's market capitalization, therefore increasing its probability of success overall. So Dalio's 3 to 5%. Other people will look at him and say, oh, well, maybe I should do 3 to 5%. They'll do the same thing. Bitcoin continues to grow. They run the same calculus again. And it's like, okay, now it's an 8, 9, 10% chance of success. And this is what Satoshi talked about so long ago when he said it could become a self-fulfilling prophecy. And that's where we're at. And it's really such an amazing time to be alive. We've never seen anything like this. If Bitcoin plays out the way we think it could, it will actually be the most transformative economic event in human history.
We are going to see some Ray Dalio comment at some point, you know.
Yeah.
Thank you, Robert. I should have read your letter.
Yeah, the funny thing about Bitcoin is nobody becomes less bullish, you know? Like once you open Pandora's box a little bit, you're like, ah, maybe 1% to 2%. Ray's going to be, he'll be all in. I don't know how long it will take, but he'll see it. I mean, the guy sits around and reads and studies all day. He's going to figure it out.
Yeah, he's going to figure it out. Do you think we are going to see a small crypto winter? I mean, in the sense, it's going to be like, perhaps.
Yeah, I think the consensus out there is that we're going to have another bull run and then a blow off top and another bear market. I have no idea, because my greatest fear in Bitcoin and the reason my strategy is to just accumulate is because at some point, I don't know where, it's like probably a psychological threshold or maybe just a market cap threshold. People are just smart money, let's say, is not going to let this thing get away from them. They're just going to start to accumulate it. If it hits a $5 trillion market cap, then all of a sudden it's taken very seriously as a macro asset. Like every capital pool on earth will need to have some exposure to it. So that will further increase its market cap. All of this emanates from its absolutely fixed supply. The fact that no one can change its supply makes it the ultimate game of accumulation, right? It's like the analogy is musical chairs. Like there's only a certain set of musical chairs. everyone's kind of circling. Well, the music of the economy is good, but when people start to sit down, there's a very limited number of seats to protect yourself from the great monetary inflation. And as that truth dawns on market participants, I think it's going to get really crazy. So the point there is I never want to try to sell a market top.
Yeah.
Bitcoin hits $500,000. Everyone's like, oh, great. I'm going to sell it here and buy it back at 250 or whatever. There's going to be a point, and it's only going to happen once in Bitcoin, that it hits some crazy number, $500,000, $1 million. People try to sell and catch it on the downside, and it just doesn't go down. It just keeps going up. And that will be could be when the dollar is starting to hyperinflate, right? Is losing relevance. So the dollar value of Bitcoin goes bananas, but it never comes back down. It'll just keep going. So that's why I don't want to miss that. I just want to accumulate as much as possible before Bitcoin eats everything. That's my strategy.
Yeah. Do you have kind of a timeline, or how long do you think that will take to happen? I mean, it's been happening quite quickly to get the price, you know, almost over 60,000, but how long is going to take to actually get to the point where Bitcoin is going to be well recognized as money?
I talk about this in my appearance with Mr. Kiyosaki, and I think the US dollar is going to hyperinflate in the next 15 years. And I think when the US dollar hyperinflates, that will be parallel with Bitcoin's final monetization, that it will pretty much eat most of the money in the world. So yeah, I'd say by the year 2035, I expect Bitcoin to be the dominant money in the world.
Awesome. I hope I'm going to still be here to watch it. It was so great, Robert. To have you on the show and to share those, those insights. So thank you so much. And I'm going to look forward to see your upcoming episode and to have you back on the show very soon.
Thank you so much. Glad to be here, Stephanie.
Okay, this is everything from the Financial Fox. I hope that you enjoy the conversation, and don't forget to subscribe to our channel, follow us on social media, and feel free to get in touch for suggestion or if you have any kind of content and feedback. I will see you next time.